This is VOA News via remote. I'm Tommy McNeil. Ukrainian authorities tried to dampen public fears over Russia's use of Iranian drones by claiming increasing success Monday and shooting them down, while the Kremlin's talk of a possible dirty bomb attack added another worrying dimension as the war enters into its ninth month. Ukrainians have been bracing for less electric power this winter following a sustained Russian barrage on the infrastructure in recent weeks. Citizens in the southern Ukrainian city lined up for water and essential supplies on Monday as Ukrainian forces advanced on the nearby Russian-occupied city of Kherson. Ukraine's forces have shot down more than two-thirds of the approximately 330 drones that Russia has fired through Saturday. That's according to the head of Ukraine's intelligence service. He also said that Russia's military has ordered about 1,700 drones of different types and is rolling out a second batch of about 300. Rishi Sunak ran for Britain's top job and lost. Then he got a second chance. The former UK Treasury chief was runner-up to Liz Truss in the contest to be prime minister. But Truss quit after a turbulent 45-day term. And Sunak has now won the Conservative leadership race. He will be Britain's first leader of color, the first Hindu to take the top job, and the youngest prime minister for more than 200 years. Victory in the Conservative leadership contest is also vindication for Sunak, who warned that Truss's tax-cutting economic plans were reckless and could cause havoc. Widely praised for overseeing billions in support to workers and businesses during the coronavirus pandemic, he's promising to ease Britain's cost of living crisis. This is VOA News. Japan has stepped up its push to catch up on digitization by telling a reluctant public they have to sign up for digital IDs or possibly lose access to their public health insurance. As the naming implies, the initiative is about assigning numbers to people similar to Social Security numbers in the U.S. Many Japanese worry the information might be misused or that their personal information might be stolen. Some view the My Number effort as a violation of their right to privacy. So the system that kicked off in 2016 has never fully caught on. Fax machines are still commonplace, and many Japanese conduct much of their business in person with cash. Some bureaucratic procedures can be done online, but many Japanese offices still require seals for stamping for identification and insist on people bringing paper forms to offices. The Biden administration is now ratcheting up pressure on President Daniel Ortega's authoritarian rule in Nicaragua, threatening a ban on Americans from doing business in the nation's gold industry, raising the possibility of trade restrictions, and stripping the U.S. visas of some 500 government insiders. The actions stemming from an executive order signed by President Joe Biden on Monday are the latest and perhaps most aggressive attempt by the U.S. to hold the former Sandinista guerrilla leader accountable for his continued attacks on human rights and democracy in the Central American country, as well as his continued security cooperation with Russia. The Associated Press has interviewed about a dozen migrants who recently arrived in the United States and agreed to share documents they received when they were released from U.S. custody while they seek asylum after crossing the border with Mexico. The AP found that most had no idea where they were going, nor did the people at the address listed. Customs and Border Protection did not respond to questions about the matter at the time, but SNAFU suggests the pattern of Border Patrol agents sending migrants without friends or family in the U.S. to offices that get no notice. The places often don't have space to house the migrants because those addresses appear on the migrants' paperwork and important notices could be sent there. Recapping our top story, Ukrainian authorities have tried to dampen public fears over Russia's use of Iranian drones by claiming increasing success in shooting them down. And the Kremlin's talk of a possible dirty bomb attack has now added another worrying dimension as the war enters its ninth month. There is more at voanews.com. Again, voanews.com. By a remote, I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News. Thank you.
Today is Tuesday, October 25th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I am Chinedofo in Washington. Coming up in the next half hour, Russian invasion of Ukraine enters its eighth month with no end in sight as human and economic losses grow.
We have confirmed information of about more than 6,000 civilians, Ukrainians dead, and more than 9,000 wounded as a result of this war.
Britain's Conservative Party chooses a new leader and prime minister amid protests from Scotland.
It is the greatest privilege of my life to be able to serve the party I love and give back to the country I owe so much to. But there is no doubt we face a profound economic challenge.
And tensions flare up as North and South Korea exchange shots near a disputed West Coast. We'll have these stories and more next on International Edition. Stay tuned. Ukrainian authorities are claiming increasing success in shooting down Iranian-built drones launched by Russia to terrorize the public. The head of Ukraine's intelligence service said Monday that Ukrainian forces have shot down 70% of the approximately 330 Shahed kamikaze drones that Russia has fired through Saturday. This as the invasion entered the eighth-month mark. Flashpoint Ukraine's Steve Miller speaks with reporter Anna Chernikova about the impact of the war on the country.
We have confirmed information of about more than 6,000 civilians, Ukrainians dead, and more than 9,000 wounded as a result of this war. These numbers could vary, of course, and could be more, but this is confirmed information that we have. And unfortunately, every day, Ukrainians continue to die. In terms of the people who had to leave their home, we know that from the beginning of the invasion in February, around 10 million people, 10 million Ukrainians left the country. For the moment, we know that more than 7 million are back, and more than 2 million of Ukrainians remain abroad and try to live in a more safe environment abroad.
And that's the human toll. What about economically?
So for the moment, we know that the losses are exceeding $127 billion. This includes the housing stock damages and, of course, infrastructure damages and energy damages. We can say that house stock damages, for the moment, at least this is what we get from the officials, has the biggest amount, which is around 40% of all losses. And this is around $50 billion. And if we compare this number to the beginning of June, this amount has increased in this last month is on $11.2 billion. So this is something that government is also considering when analyzing this war and analyzing the support Ukraine needs, long-term support Ukraine would require.
That's reporter Anna Chernikova speaking with Flashpoint Ukraine Steve Miller from Kyiv. Rishi Sunak will become Britain's next prime minister after he won the race to lead the Conservative Party. Sunak now has the task of steering a deeply divided country through an economic downturn set to leave millions of people poorer. Lauren Anthony of Reuters reports.
I am humbled and honoured to have the support of my parliamentary colleagues and to be elected as leader of the Conservative and Unionist Party.
Rishi Sunak will become Britain's next Prime Minister after he won the race to lead the Conservative Party on Monday.
Rishi Sunak is therefore elected as leader of the Conservative Party.
The former Finance Minister is Britain's third Prime Minister in less than 2 months.
It is the greatest privilege of my life to be able to serve the party I love and give back to the country I owe so much to. The United Kingdom is a great country, but there is no doubt we face a profound economic challenge. We now need stability and unity, and I will make it my utmost priority to bring our party and our country together.
He will replace Liz Truss, the outgoing leader, who lasted just 44 days in the job before she resigned.
That I am resigning as leader of the Conservative Party.
Sunak defeated centrist politician Penny Mordaunt, He failed to get enough backing from lawmakers to enter the ballot.
I can assure the House.
His other main rival, former Prime Minister Boris Johnson, withdrew from the contest, saying he could no longer unite the party after one of the most turbulent periods in British political history.
Hasta la vista, baby. Thank you.
One of the wealthiest politicians in Westminster, multimillionaire and former hedge fund boss Sunak, will now face a daunting set of challenges. Speaking to Conservative Party lawmakers Monday, Sunak said his first priority was to deliver economic stability.
But be in no doubt, I am the underdog.
But that won't be an easy task. He'll be expected to launch deep spending cuts to try to rebuild Britain's fiscal reputation just as the country slides into a recession, dragged down by the surging costs of energy and food. The pound and British government bonds jumped briefly on news of Mordaunt's withdrawal, but soon returned to their previous levels. Sunak will also be presiding over a party that has bounced from one crisis to the next in recent months. As it stands, Conservatives are badly split along ideological lines, and the public is increasingly angry at the conduct of its politicians. Sunak first came to national attention when he became finance minister under Johnson, just as the global health crisis hit Britain. Set to be the country's first leader of colour and the youngest prime minister in more than 200 years, he'll be asked to form a government by King Charles.
That's Lauren Anthony of Reuters. Scottish First Minister Nicola Sturgeon said on Monday, Britain's new prime minister Rishi Sunak's Conservative Party has, quote, no mandate, unquote. Speaking during a visit to a children's home in Coatbridge, Scotland, Sturgeon said choosing a new leader by Tory MPs, or at most by the membership of the Tory party, is not democratic.
Rishi Sunak will be yet another Tory Prime Minister that Scotland hasn't voted for. Scotland was given the opportunity today. I would bet my bottom dollar that Scotland would not vote for Rishi Sunak as Prime Minister. So this is the position Scotland is in, having to cross our fingers and hope for the least worst option in terms of UK governments. And again, I would say we can do better than this. We can choose our own governments and we can actually apply our own values to leading Scotland on the track that we want, rather than being taken down the wrong track by successive UK governments. Back in the European Union and in charge of our own destiny, that's what independence offers Scotland, and it's got to be better than this chaos and economic carnage that has been inflicted on us by one Tory Prime Minister after another. It's going to be the fifth Prime Minister in the years that I've been First Minister. Now, I'm only saying that to illustrate the instability and the uncertainty and the chaos that the Tories have unleashed on all of us. They have no mandate. And, you know, it is a democratic necessity that people get their say on who occupies number 10 Downing Street, and that this isn't just decided by Tory MPs or at most by the membership of the Tory party. It's a democratic outrage that that should be yet again what people are being expected to put up with. There needs to be a general election because the Tories have no mandate, not just for the personality who walk into number 10 this week, but for the policies that they are going to pursue.
That's Scottish First Minister Nicola Sturgeon. Angela Rayner, deputy leader of the opposition Labour Party, said on Monday that the country needed a general election as newly elected Conservative Party leader Rishi Sunak had no mandate to lead. Rayner added that Sunak had failed to address sluggish growth during his time as finance minister. North and South Korea said they exchanged warning shots near a disputed area of their west coast Monday. It is the latest flare-up of military tensions on the Korean Peninsula, as VOA's Bill Gallo reports from Seoul, South Korea.
South Korea's military said it fired warning shots at a North Korean commercial ship that crossed the de facto Korean sea border early Monday. About 90 minutes later, North Korea fired 10 warning shots of its own. The North accused a South Korean military vessel of crossing the border. At a briefing, South Korean military spokesman Kim Jun-rok said North Korea's actions violated an inter-Korean military agreement. He urged the North to stop its provocations. North Korea has conducted a record number of missile tests this year. It's also conducted provocative artillery shelling near the sea border. In response, the United States and its ally South Korea have ramped up their own displays of military strength. After Monday's incident, South Korea announced major military drills off its west coast. Inter-Korean ties appear to be entering a particularly dangerous phase, with each side blaming the other for creating tensions. According to Seoul-based North Korea scholar Park Won-gon, North Korea is employing a familiar strategy of brinkmanship. Park says at the climax of the cycle of North Korean provocations is a likely nuclear test, the North's seventh since 2006. North Korea periodically ramps up military tensions, often to create leverage ahead of talks with the United States. But North Korea has consistently rejected recent offers of dialogue. In September, its leader Kim Jong-un said there would be absolutely no denuclearization, no negotiation, and no bargaining chip to trade. Bill Gallo, VOA News, Seoul, South Korea.
Tensions between Turkey and Greece are escalating over a number of territorial disputes. Analysts say the countries have a long history of managing such tensions. They say that expertise will be tested with the approaching Greek and Turkish elections, where both leaders are expected to play to nationalist sentiments. Dorian Jones reports from Istanbul.
The Turkish army practice amphibious landings in their annual military exercises not far from neighboring Greek islands. At the same time, Greece continues to modernize its military, closing the gap with its Turkish rival, all as bilateral tensions rise over a myriad of territorial disputes over the Aegean and Mediterranean seas. Senem Aydın Duzkit is a professor of international relations at Sabancı University outside Istanbul.
The current Turkish-Greek relationship at the official level, I think it's extremely tense, both because of the changing balances in the Eastern Mediterranean, but also I think because of Turkey's domestic politics, which sees a certain degree of interest in asserting a much more unilateral nationalist foreign policy.
Addressing supporters at a rally recently, Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan said Turkish forces could come one night to Greek islands that Ankara is demanding be demilitarized. Greek Foreign Minister Nikos Dendeas, meanwhile, compared Turkey to Russia during a recent visit to Ukraine. The increasingly inflammatory comments from both sides come as incursions by the two countries' warplanes become a regular occurrence. Mesut Çarşım is a presidential advisor at Istanbul's Yeditepe University.
Yarın bir gün, Türk uçaklarından veya gemilerinden.
He said, tomorrow or any day, if Turkish planes or naval ships or our tanks at the border get fired upon, Turkey will have to retaliate. But this retaliation could escalate and you could start a war but cannot finish it. But tensions and threats are nothing new between the two NATO members. The two are maintaining contact, with Turkish Defense Minister Hulusi Akar inviting his counterpart Nikolaos Panagiotopoulos to visit Turkey. Observers say the two countries are skilled at managing tensions. Seha Güvenç, an international relations professor at Kadahas University in Istanbul, says both have shown they know how to avoid conflicts. Dorian Jones for VOA News, Istanbul.
Thank you, Dorian. Delegations to African Union mediated peace talks on the war in Ethiopia's Tigray region met in South Africa today despite a renewed offensive that saw federal forces retake a few towns from Tigrayan forces. Kate Butler reports from Johannesburg, South Africa.
The Ethiopian government put out a statement saying it viewed the talks as an opportunity to peacefully resolve the conflict. For their part, the leadership of the Tigray People's Liberation Front, or the TPLF, also confirmed their attendance, with a member of the Central Committee, Kendeya Gabri Hewitt, tweeting that the delegation had arrived in South Africa Sunday. The Tigray delegation is being led by one of the region's top generals, Taksan Gabretuse, spokesman Geta Chaureda, an official familiar with the talks, told Reuters. The Tigrayans arrived on a U.S. military aircraft accompanied by the U.S. Special Envoy to the Horn of Africa, Mike Hammer, the official told Reuters. Officials from host country South Africa were remaining mum on the much-anticipated negotiations, and their exact location is unclear. It is also unclear whether media will be addressed at their conclusion or a statement released. Clayson Moniela, a spokesman for South Africa's Department of International Relations and Cooperation, told VOA the department had no authority to speak on the talks and referred any questions to the African Union, which is organizing them. A spokesperson for the AU could not immediately be reached. The talks come as fighting on the ground intensified, with the Ethiopian government saying they had continued taking control of major urban centers the past few days. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres warned last week that the situation was spiraling out of control, while World Health Organization Chief Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus, himself a Tigrayan, warned of the possibility of genocide. Thousands of people have been killed and millions displaced since the conflict broke out in late 2020. The U.S. has expressed hope that the peace talks in South Africa will lead to a cessation of hostilities. Secretary of State Antony Blinken said Sunday he had spoken to South African counterpart Naledi Pandor on how to make the peace talks successful. From the Vatican over the weekend, Pope Francis tweeted, "I follow the persistent situation of conflict in Ethiopia with trepidation. May the efforts of the parties for dialogue lead to a genuine path of reconciliation." Kate Bartlett, VOA News, Johannesburg.
In other news, Sudan's ruling military has sacked a commander in the southern Blue Nile province after 2 days of fierce tribal clashes there, which left at least 230 people dead. The unrest added to the woes of a country mired in civil conflict and political chaos. Fighting in Blue Nile pits the Hausa tribe against the Bertha people. Tensions escalated last week in the town of Wadi El Mahi on the border with Ethiopia. The violence came ahead of the first anniversary of Sudan's military coup that upended the nation's short-lived transition to democracy. You're listening to VOA's International Edition. I am Chinedu Ofor in Washington. In marking World Polio Day, advocates for a polio-free world are urging nations to commit to a new five-year strategy to eradicate this crippling disease and consign it to the trash bin of history. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
An estimated 350,000 children were paralyzed by polio when the World Health Organization launched its global polio eradication initiative in 1988. In the world today, polio is endemic only in Pakistan and Afghanistan. So far this year, 29 cases have been recorded, putting the possibility of a polio-free world within reach. The WHO notes the final stretch is the most difficult and cautions nations against letting down their guard too soon. WHO Director General Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus says the 29 recorded cases include a small number in Southeast Africa linked to a strain originating in Pakistan.
While it does not affect the WHO African region's wild polio-free certification, it shows us that as long as polio continues to circulate anywhere, it's a threat to children everywhere. Despite this news, we have a unique window of opportunity right now to end polio for good.
The WHO warns polio also can spread within communities through circulating vaccine-derived polioviruses. These variants, it notes, can emerge in places where not enough people have been immunized against this crippling disease. It reports these variants continue to spread across parts of Africa, Asia, and Europe, and new outbreaks have been detected in Britain, Israel, and the United States in recent months. UNICEF Executive Director Catherine Russell says the new polio eradication strategy is designed to take the world to the finish line. She says the strategy includes tactics to protect children from variant outbreaks and stop their spread to other countries.
We're also working with governments to speed up our response to these outbreaks, acting immediately to ensure that they do not harm more children. And we continue working to integrate polio activities with other immunization and health programs so we can reach high-risk children who've never received vaccines before. The new strategy will help us end all forms of polio. It will also help prepare countries to respond to future health threats.
If this goal is reached, polio will become only the second disease after smallpox to have been wiped off the face of the earth. UN health agencies say it will cost $4.8 billion to achieve this historic milestone. The economic returns, they say, will be significant. They estimate eradicating polio would result in savings of more than $33 billion. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
The world's population is surging, and with it, a global demand for poultry and seafood. Some countries are hoping to offer meat-based products grown in a lab with the same taste and texture as animal flesh. VOA's Julie Tabor has more.
As the world demand for fish and meat increases, some companies are trying to find novel ways to supplement existing supplies. Ricardo San Martin, who runs the Alternative Meats Lab at UC Berkeley, says bringing cell-based products to the mass market may not be realistic anytime soon.
Scaling up just cells to produce meat, that's not feasible. We need to know how affordable this will be. This is going to be a solution for everyone or just an elite?
Alternative meat companies acknowledge that their concept is still a work in progress. It's progress that is moving slowly, but could one day change how the world eats. Julie Tabo, VOA News.
Protests have been growing inside and outside Iran, initially sparked by the death in police custody of Mahsa Amini, a young woman arrested by Iran's morality police for not having her hair fully covered. Each Wednesday, go beyond the breaking news with VOA's Flashpoint Iran. Listen online at voanews.com or in your podcast player.
This has been International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of the entire production team, thank you so much for listening. Visit our website for in-depth coverage of world events and news 24 hours at voanews.com and check out voaafrica.com for more English language programming. You can find International Edition on our current affairs programs, Encounter, Press Conference USA and Issues in the News on voanews.com. Until next time, I am Chino Rofo in Washington, wishing you a wonderful day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States will live up to its commitments in the Indo-Pacific. Secretary of Defense Lloyd Austin said in a recent interview, "We continue to work to make sure that we have the right capabilities in the right places to ensure that we help our allies maintain a free and open Indo-Pacific." When asked about the People's Republic of China's increased military activity and incursions into the Taiwan Strait, Secretary of Defense Austin said, "China is moving to establish what we would call a new normal. We saw a number of centerline crossings of the Taiwan Strait by their aircraft, and that number has increased over time. We've seen more activity in their surface vessels in the waters in and around Taiwan." The defense secretary stressed that the United States does not want to see a unilateral change to the status quo regarding Taiwan, and that the One China policy of the United States has not changed. He noted that in accordance with the Taiwan Relations Act, we're committed to helping Taiwan develop the capability to defend itself, and that work has gone on over time. It will continue into the future. Last month on her trip to Asia, Vice President Kamala Harris underscored the same commitment in her remarks aboard the USS Howard in Yokosuka, Japan. She noted the PRC's disturbing behavior in the East China Sea and in the South China Sea, and most recently provocations across the Taiwan Strait. "We will continue to oppose any unilateral change to the status quo," the vice president said, "and we will continue to support Taiwan's self-defense consistent with our long-standing policy." Taiwan, she stated, is a vibrant democracy that contributes to the global good, from technology to health and beyond, and the United States will continue to deepen our unofficial ties. The United States does not seek conflict or a Cold War with the PRC. "In fact," said Vice President Harris, "we will work with every willing nation to solve global challenges." "The United States is a proud Pacific power," the vice president declared. The presence of the United States in the Indo-Pacific is in pursuit of peace and stability and to support our allies and partners.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.